Welcome to Engelberg Center Live, a collection of audio from events held by the Engelberg Center on Innovation, Law, and Policy at NYU Law.
This episode is the What's in the Toolkit? Tools and Evidence panel from the Revising the Antitrust Merger Guidelines event. It was recorded on September 29th, 2023.
Okay, why don't we get started? Hi, I'm Chris Sprigman. I'm a professor here at the law school, and it's my honor to introduce the panel. And I want to start with one of my three wonderful antitrust colleagues who we're here to honor, Daniel Rubenfeld, who's professor of law at NYU School of Law, and the Robert L. Bridges Professor of Law Emeritus and Professor of Economics Emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley. You all know him well, but let me just say a few words that can't possibly sum up Dan's productive and varied career. First, Dan has a long publication record relating to antitrust and competition policy, law and economics, and public economics. And when I went back and looked at the scope of Dan's work, what struck me was his great range, mixing technological and theoretical approaches across many issues in law and economics, always with rigor and always with, you know, a kind of spark of inventiveness and excitement. From his book on democratic federalism to his textbooks on microeconomics and econometric models and economic forecasts, to recent work on data standardization with Michal Gal, who I see here, IP privateering, and common ownership, and coordinated effects with Ed Rock, who I saw earlier. Dan's work has set a standard of excellence in the field, one which I hope a new generation of antitrust scholars will work to meet. And as with many of the best in our field, Dan served in government from June 1997 to December 1998 as Deputy Assistant Attorney General at DOJ, and also as a consultant for the FTC, the Antitrust Division, and a number of state attorney generals. Dan's leadership in the field has been recognized over many years and in many ways. He's been a fellow at the National Bureau of Economic Research, the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences, and the Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation. He holds an honorary doctorate from the University of Basel in Switzerland and is a member of the Academy of Arts and Sciences. And I just want to end with a note of appreciation for Dan's warmth and generosity as a colleague. Even before I came to NYU, my impression of Dan, Harry, and Eleanor was much the same, meaning I saw them as three incredibly accomplished, rigorous antitrust scholars who were also collaborative and open to the ideas and energy of junior scholars. And Dan, thank you for that. I want to introduce the rest of the panel and then quickly get started because we have a lot to go through. Jennifer Malici is a partner in the DC office of Wilmer Hale and the former chief trial counsel of the US Federal Trade Commission's Bureau of Competition. She focuses her practice on representing clients in high-profile litigation and helping clients navigate an antitrust complex environment. Aviv Niro is the George Weiss and Linda Bravo Weiss University professor with appointments in the economics department in the School of Arts and Sciences and the marketing department at Wharton. He's on leave right now, serving as director of the FTC's Bureau of Economics. And Andy Gavel is a member of the Howard Law Faculty and has been since 1989, teaching antitrust law, civil procedure, complex litigation, federal courts, and Supreme Court jurisprudence. So let's get started. And Aviva, I just wanted to start with you, just by building on Daniel Francis's excellent question from before, which is, you know, what's new here from the perspective of this panel, which is the economic toolkit in the guidelines? How would you identify the biggest, the most important differences between 2010 and the new draft?
Thank you, Chris. Then I was going to ask you in the break to ask that question again at the end. And please do, if after you hear my comments, you don't feel it sort of answered. So first, I'd like to thank the organizers for putting together this really excellent event and for inviting me to speak in it. I'm especially honored to be on the same panel with Dan. Dan and I were colleagues at Berkeley. I joined actually at the summer of 1997. Just as Jan went off to the DOJ, I always took it very personally that, you know, his timing, but we got over it, and when he came back, he pulled me in to work on one of his most important projects that he was working on at the DOJ. Now, surely you think that might be the Microsoft case. Like, no. Something far more important, which was the prices or the pricing of academic journals. Something that's important for all of us. So Dan and I wrote a very, what I think, but of course I'm biased, a very interesting paper on the topic. Dan's always served for me always kind of as an inspiration and really a model to follow, because those of you who kind of looked at, you know, the kind of Dan's sort of cohort, a lot of actually also my ex-colleagues from Berkeley and antitrust, Dan always stood out to me as being kind of the one that was most, you know, from an economics point of view, the most of an econometrician, the most that kind of cared about, you know, methods and data and looking carefully at the data, and has always been an inspiration for me as I've sort of plotted my own way at antitrust, and, you know, many years later took the position that Dan had at DOJ, filled it myself. And I dare say, although Dan might actually hold this against me and try to deny it completely, that there's an impact of that thinking that for me started, you know, with Dan and has kind of inspired me. There is an impact of that in the draft merger guidelines. Okay, so, you know, if there's something you don't like, you can blame Dan. It's all from him. But no, seriously, I mean, I'm not sure we'll get a chance to talk about that. But as you dive into the details of the appendix and how we talk about econometric methods, I actually think these are the first guidelines to talk about econometrics methods. Daniel, note number one new thing. Would it impact courts? I don't know. I'm not going to try to say that. It is actually, in my view, starting from a tradition that really, you know, started with Dan and that we're hoping to continue. So anyway, let me kind of get to the actual question. I do need to say before I start that the usual disclaimer, the views I'm about to say, I think will become very clear, are my own and do not represent that of the commission or any individual commissioner. So the goal of the merger guidelines, kind of just to sort of step back, is to update the guidelines to really deal with issues in the modern economy. So if I were giving a speech now and I had to title it, you know, or let me just say, from an economic perspective, that really means sort of sharpening the existing tools, the methods, and as well as adding new ones, right? So if I actually had to title kind of my comments as a, give them a title, I would say something like, you know, a modern merger enforcement toolkit for the modern economy. Okay, now, some of you, especially given the discussion we had in the previous panel, saying, you know, what did he have for breakfast? You know, I want some of that. Because how can you talk about a modern toolkit on guidelines that refer to old case law, right? We had a lot of that discussion before. So let me try to sort of take that head on and kind of make a few comments on that and see how the two things, I think, you know, interact or don't together. So first, let me just start with a general sort of notion is that I really refuse to accept the idea that something is bad just because it's old, right? So just because something is over 50 years old doesn't make it bad. And just for the record, I am over 50 years old, and that's part of it. I especially find that something that we're unwilling to accept an event like this, honoring our three distinguished antitrust scholars. But more seriously, just the fact that the cases are old is not relevant. The relevant question, I think what was discussed kind of on the panel before, is whether they do represent the current state of law or not. I'm an economist, so I get an easy pass on this one and say, I don't know. Okay, you guys go figure it out and come and tell me later. I should note, though, that the intention in the guideline, and here again, speaking as an economist, is a good one. It basically says, let's start with the case law, right? What's the legal foundation? Because as much as we'd like to say this is an economic exercise, I mean, let's be clear, it's not. It's an economic exercise done within a context of a legal framework, right? So it'd be great if we could sort of agree, here's the legal framework, here's what it says, here are the general economic principles that build from that, right? And then here's how it translates to actual tools that we use, okay? That's the ideal. I think that's the ideal we all strive for. But I think to achieve that ideal, we'd probably have to write not a 51-page document, but something like a 500-page document. And even there, I think there'll be a lot of controversy. So I think what happens is there's the discussion that we have on the case law that we heard on the previous panel is there. So from my perspective, it becomes a little bit of a distraction. Okay, I think it's a good discussion to have. As I said, go off, have that discussion on your own, tell me what you decided at the end, so that we as an economist can then take on and do that. But what I would rather do is to actually go in and dive into the details. So let me talk about the details and then maybe more directly address the points. And I'll stop here at some point. So let me just actually start with the structure or the horizontal horizontal guidelines and then stop. We can then go back and talk about others as well. So as a general matter, I think one of the strengths of these guidelines is that they clearly lay out sort of various paths for the agencies to explore when investigating a merger, right? And that's part of the issue that we need to understand is that, you know, the modern economy, there's a lot, different industries, competition presents itself in different ways in these different industries, and it's hard to sort of fit things into kind of neat little boxes, okay? So the very first thing we need is we need more boxes, and that's what we do here, right? We try to introduce, here are kind of different ways of looking. A lot of them are building on ideas that were existing before, not all of them. For example, you know, the potential competition guideline 4, it's an idea that wasn't in 2010, right? There's other guidelines of that as well, and there's other ones where we're trying to build up what we do. The other thing that we try to do is to move, remove labels. So I do think that one of the big issues that we face in kind of modern markets is the fact that we like to put a label on everything, right? We want to call this a horizontal merger. This is a vertical merger, okay? I actually think in modern markets, that distinction makes absolutely no sense, okay? There are horizontal effects. There are maybe non-horizontal effects. I think in many cases, okay, you're going to have a combination of them. So what we do is we try to have the horizontal effects in some guidelines, non-horizontal in others, but not label any particular merger as being one or the other. Let me stop here. I'm sure we'll get into kind of some of the other comments later.
So I'm really interested in everyone's reaction to this emphasis on structural presumptions. So first thing is we can talk about guideline 1 moves the structural presumption back to pre-2010 levels. And I want to ask what people think about this. What's the economic reasoning behind it? Will it change merger enforcement from the perspective of the lawyers? Jennifer, maybe you have a view on that.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for the invitation to be here. I'm very honored to be sitting on this stage with this group of people. Unlike everybody else, I'm, of course, not an economist, and I'm not a scholar. So I am coming at this really from the perspective of a litigator, of a career spent litigating, and how does this work in courts? What are we presenting? How does this change how a court views things? And I wanted to pick up on something Rohan said in the last panel, which is that, like, courts, when they have a merger case, they look at it and they say, from everything I've seen, is this a bad merger? And is it a bad merger in a way I should care about? And a lot of what gets a court there, it has nothing to do with this. It's having customers come in and complain, or injured parties come in and say in a credible way, if this merger happens, I'm going to be impacted. So I want to start there, that's the framework when we're getting to court, is what evidence are you going to present and how does that tell the court that it's a bad merger? As to the change in the structural presumption here, I think that the draft merger guidelines actually do a pretty good job of explaining why that change is made, that it's consistent with a prior limit, and why, you know, in the past it was changed to reflect prosecutorial discretion, and now there's new prosecutorial discretion. I don't have an issue with that. I think one of the things that Aviv started with to keep in mind here is that there are a lot of good ideas in these guidelines, but when we put them in a framework that that gives the other side room to really say there's a problem with this, there's a problem with how, with the reasoning here, that's not what this case means, and the other side can really attack it in a brief, then that makes all of it a little bit more suspect. And so, my reaction to this is I think that the structural change is good. It makes sense. You get concerned by what's around it, of whether that will be accepted and will be persuasive to the court.
Andy, any views on this re-emphasis on structure, and in particular how the presumption has been set in a number of ways? So I mentioned the lowering of the presumption to pre-2010 levels. Also, the second part of Guideline 1, extending it where post-merger HHI is below 1,800, but in where one merging party has a share of 30% or more and the delta HHI is above 100, right? So we have some very specific changes, and I wanted to get a sense, both you and Dan might have a view of how that will affect enforcement.
Sure. Thank you, and obviously I am sitting in for Nancy. I am not Nancy. I appreciate the opportunity. So 2 points I'd like to make. One is antitrust law is law. It always has been law. But it's a law that implements economic policy. It's about competition. And so it is always going to be about law and economics. And it can be very difficult to fuse the two in the context of legal decisions. One way we do that in law is with presumptions. And presumptions are a very important way, not just in antitrust law, across all law, of simplifying and fixing reasonable burdens without requiring proof of every little detail. And my view of where these new guidelines go is an attempt to sort of restore some faith in presumptions, because over time, I agree with the point Eleanor made this morning, courts have become extraordinarily demanding of facts and evidence. One thing we haven't talked about is the degree to which the guidelines themselves are responsible for that. I think with subsequent iterations of the guidelines and efforts to more perfectly kind of provide for the economic structure of arguments, defense lawyers are very clever. And every time we added something new to the guidelines about, oh, this is how you could better do coordinated effects, this is how you could better do unilateral effects, that was used against the agencies to raise their burden, case by case. And so the importance of the core structural presumption faded over time, maybe as we occasionally still say in law school, but not as often as we used to. The agencies were hoisted by their own petard. Okay, I got that out. I feel good about saying that. But it was in this, you know, effort to more highly specify standards. The 1800, I think the 2010 raising to 2500 was the exception. This is sort of a return to where it was. I don't think anyone accused Baxter in 1982 of adopting 1800 and that it was far too aggressive. If anything, at that point, it was viewed as very permissive. So going back to the 1800 seems to me to be restoring something that maybe we didn't have the best basis for changing in 2010. We could talk about what the rationale was. It better reflected what the agencies were doing. But it was like raising the speed limit and inviting people to go even faster. 1800 is based on a theory of 6 to 5. Numerical, you know, characteristics of the HHI. I'm comfortable with that being a better place where we should start looking more deeply at mergers than waiting until we are 4 to 3 and 3 to 2. So I think it's quite justified, and we should look at 2010 as the departure from the norm rather than this year's.
Dan, anything to add on that?
Sure. I've always thought of the guidelines as doing a couple of different things. One is to just give a reasonably accurate characterization of what the agencies are actually doing, another would be to maybe be looking forward and saying, well, this is our aspiration, this is where we're heading now, and this is what you can see with respect to litigation that follows. And so just focusing on the 1800 number for just characterizing what's highly concentrated industry, I think going back to that number is defensible, based on the merger cases I've seen being brought. And that makes perfect sense. There are other parts of the Delta 100 sticks, although I have to say in the time I was in the government, we never brought a merger case where the Delta was anything close to 100. It was typically 500 or more. but that raises a separate point, which is when firms are reading the guidelines and seeing any of the numbers like 1800 or the more questionable number, I would say, which is a 30% number, that's a different issue, they're going to take that as a signal as to what they can do and not do. So I think it's important to be conservative in that regard, and with the 1800 number, I think it's quite defensible. Some of the other numbers get me nervous, as I said. The other thing I just wanted to say is that the guidelines, ideally, in my view, would be ones that continue to improve on what was done back in 2010 and even before then. And there are elements of the guidelines that really do that. other elements for me make too big a break. The parts that I'm now moving ahead a bit, the parts that I think are important that I like are the parts where the agencies are taking on some of the phenomenon that I didn't have to deal with back when I was in the government, and their whole range of issues. Avi mentioned moving the vertical guidelines here. I think that's a real plus. I still have some questions about the exact numbers that are being utilized, but I think Aviv is correct in pointing out that mergers that have a vertical component have significant horizontal implications, and there's no reason that that shouldn't be considered together in the new guidelines. I should stop there because I'm bridging into a new topic.
You move to a topic that is of a lot of interest in the guidelines. The 2023 draft, as far as I can see, seems to be animated by an effort to reinvigorate vertical enforcement. There's a pretty traditional discussion in Guideline 5.
Chris, can I, before we go on,
sure.
I mean, I'm happy to...
No, of course.
Can I just weigh in a little bit on, before we move on to vertical, I think a couple of things I just wanted to say.
Yeah, absolutely,
if that's
please.
Okay.
Yep.
So first, let me just kind of touch on the issue of presumptions, because it was actually discussed a lot in the previous panel. Seems to be more agreement here. Partly in response, I think kind of Doug sort of laid out like, okay, what's the economic intuition, the idea behind that? We didn't spend any time kind of in guideline one, the horizontal presumptions, talking about that because we actually felt this was a case where we actually weren't changing that much from 2010. Sorry, Daniel, looking at you again because as an answer to your original question. I mean, yeah, we changed the threshold, but I say change, we basically returned to what it was historically. And I think the intuition, which I don't think, this doesn't sound like there's a lot of dispute here, but I have heard elsewhere, like, well, where are these coming from? Well, the intuition is a very simple one, right? If I ask you, you know nothing more about a merger. All you know is one merger is a 10-9, the other is a 3-2. And I told you, which of these two should you be more worried about? Which of these two should you direct more resources to look at? You'd probably say the latter. And I think that's kind of a general agreement across everyone. I mean, some academics said, no, we can write a model in which you'd worry more about 10-9 and 3-2. It's like, yeah, I'm sure, you know, if you give them enough incentive, they will find a way to write that model. But that's an academic exercise, right? I think actually practitioners would all agree we want to sort of draw that line. And that's what we're trying to do with the structural presumption. That's what we've always tried to do. Now, where exactly do you draw that line? Look, we can pretend as if we have some magic model that spits out, 1,800 instead of 2,500. We don't, okay? They never had an 82 when they set the 1,800, and that's kind of where we are. As to the 30%, one thing I'd like to point out, and I mentioned this to Daniel at the end of the previous panel, if you heard the previous panel, you would have walked away probably with two impressions. One, 82 is radical, but radical in one direction. 2010 is radical in another, the current draft merger guidelines are radical in another direction. Okay, let me just point out one small thing. In terms of the structural presumption, the horizontal structural presumption, before we go to vertical, horizontal structural presumption, we are heading back to the 1982 thresholds of 1800. And not only that, most people don't remember this, 1982 also had a market share presumption. It wasn't 30%, it was 35%, and there were a few additional qualifiers. Okay, but if you let me round, 30 and 35 in the same ballpark, so yeah, we're going back to the real, radical, whatever, liberal thresholds of 1982. So let's put sort of things within context, not necessarily that I'm going to defend, the 30% as something that we know strictly, but let's kind of put this within the historical context before we get sort of too worked up of, is it going to make about, is this a radical change? The other thing to note is this, again, going down, the question is, will it really matter? Are there really going to be a lot of cases that are going to get caught because of the 30% and not anything else? I doubt it. And that is, something we haven't talked about. These are all rebuttable presumptions and rebuttable by exactly the type of economic evidence that we would look to say, in this particular case, this concentration is not meaningful. So
good point. And I just want to... ask Jennifer, so given that these are all rebuttable presumptions, how do judges typically think of what it means to rebut them? Is this a huge hill to climb? Is it a modest hill to climb? And does the steepness of the hill depend on whether the judge thinks the presumption makes sense?
Thank you for the question, and that was kind of a reaction I was having to what Andy was saying earlier, is that you know, when you try these cases, you're coming into court and you're saying, I've met the presumption, but you don't stop there. I've never had a case or seen a case where the FTC says, we've met the presumption and we sit down, right? You also say, we've met the presumption, but even if we didn't, there's substantial head-to-head competition that's going to be lost and people are going to be injured. And even if that wasn't true, we have this other evidence of harm to competition. And so you're always putting on that entire case. That's part of your opening brief. That's part of what you're putting on in your case in chief. You don't say, presumption, I rest, right? So this is always how the cases have been presented. And so I think that that's kind of an issue with how people think of the presumption. I don't know that courts have been holding the agencies to some really high standard of proof so much as they're evaluating the evidence before them, which includes evidence that the presumption is met and includes lots of evidence from market participants about whether this merger is going to be good or bad for people in the marketplace.
Okay, one more question on this, Andy, really directed toward you. So what I heard Aviv say is these presumptions are an attempt to balance a whole bunch of factors that are important. So one is, you know, how difficult do we think it is to predict in any particular merger what's going to happen? So we can use rules of thumb to sort things into categories and treat them differently, at least initially, based on the presumptions. You know, we have to think about the likelihood of type 1 versus type 2 errors, the cost to the economy and to society of the different types of error. So these are all necessarily, in a sense, imprecise, predictive, and, you know, depending on your ideology, you may come to different conclusions. How should courts receive these changes when the agency does all this thinking, some of which is technical, some of which may be political? How should the courts receive the new thresholds?
I think the sliding scale concept that you find in Baker Hughes and Hines is a possible answer to that, that not all mergers are created equal. And the presumption, we keep using the word as if it's one thing.
Right.
But presumptions can be very strong, presumptions can be weaker. In Aviv's example, you know, the 10 to 9, 9 to 8, that's maybe a weaker presumption than the 3 to 2. And as Baker, Hughes, and Hines say, the presumption can be much stronger, and then the evidence to rebut, going to Jennifer's point, must also be a lot more persuasive before we're going to take the risk. And that's what this is. It's risk assessment of what are the, you know, most likely consequences. And that's where I think, as I said earlier, where the economics and the law are meeting, trying to do an assessment of risk, and especially when it's prospective, it is hard. You're making a prediction about what is going to be the risk after this merger of the effects we're concerned about.
Dan?
I was going to, thinking back of an illustration of how these issues came before, I can say now that I was the expert for the Department of Justice when we were looking at the AT&T T-Mobile deal. And it was kind of a fun deal because the opposing expert for AT&T was my friend Dennis Carlton. And we did a lot of work at DOJ, and the work that I did, we both put together an analysis of market shares. And by the way, market definitions was important, so we defined both local geographic markets as well as a national market. And within both of those markets, we're able to sort of do the usual analysis of shares. But the market was differentiated, so I actually did a fairly complex econometric analysis that allowed me to make predictions, specific predictions as to what would happen in individual markets. Now, eventually, based probably more on the work of the FTC, which was John Baker was actually doing a lot of work
FCC.
There, the deal cratered. But what's interesting about it is I think it didn't crater just based on the 1800 numbers, but I think that was enough to, that was going to catch the attention of the courts. But it also cratered because we had all the backup analysis ready to go. We had all the econometrics, all of that ready to go. And interestingly enough, Fiona was the chief economist at DOJ at the time, and she did something very interesting. She organized a meeting of the experts for both sides. So we had a very nice dinner meeting with Fiona and Dennis and myself, I think one other person, where we talked about the differences and how the work would have gone. And in the end, sort of the structural presumption underlaid the case had a huge impact. I'd like to think it was going to be all the econometrics that I did, but none of that was made public. Here it is now. Anyone can ask me about it.
So I just want to emphasize, and I mean, those of you that saw visually, so I was nodding to a lot of the comments. I just want to make clear that the comments that we made here and kind of the comments that were made is exactly, I think, the intention of how we see this moving forward. So even though literally, you know, the guidelines say, well, we can bring a case under any one of these independently, so we could go only structural or actually only on guideline two, which is unilateral effects. I view that in a very high percentage, whether it's 90 or 95% or something like that, of the cases, they will be completely the way that they've always been, which is, yes, there's a structural presumption that's going to be brought in together with a kind of more complete economic analysis, whether it's a merger simulation, econometric analysis, or whether it's some win-loss data or anything like that, whatever we have, that's how it will be brought. So in that sense, there isn't going to be a huge... so why have it sort of broken up that way? Because I think there are going to be a few cases on either extreme where you could imagine going slightly differently. Right? So I could imagine a case where we only go structural. Now, we're not talking about a case where the HHI is 1801 and the delta is 101. I mean, we're talking a case where it's essentially a, you know, either a merger to monopoly or close to it. Again, I don't want to put a threshold there. So what I have in mind is, those of you who know the Williams and Drew case where I actually worked for the FTC, where the arguments that we had in court was whether post-merger, the merging party would have 85% market share or 60% market share. Okay? You kind of think like that's a waste of everyone's time. It's a waste of the agency's time, and more importantly, it's a waste of the court's time. Right? Those are cases that should be easy to sort of, let's go either case, 85% share, 60% share. Really, that's not a merger that should have actually made it out of the boardroom, let alone actually got litigated. So I think that's the point we want to simplify. The other extreme is actually cases that would go without a structural presumption. Now, whether those will ever be brought, I don't know, but at least we have a pathway. And why do we need that pathway? Again, this goes back to the modern economy where sometimes to define a market to get the presumption, you might need 7 adjectives. Okay, that's usually a general rule, is the more adjectives you need to describe a market, the weaker your case is going to be. Okay, kind of to put things kind of a simple way. So we say, well, why don't we go to a world where we're only going to use 2 adjectives to define the market, not 7, go broad, give up on the presumption, and just go on the economic effects. Now, will that be successful? I don't know. Will you ever find either an AAG or a commission or a litigator that's willing to bring that case? I don't know. But that's the path we're trying to open.
Okay.
So to be clear, litigators will bring all cases.
Yeah, no, exactly. Eventually. So I wanted to move to vertical. And, you know, again, the guidelines seem to start in 5 with a pretty traditional discussion of vertical mergers. And then I see there's guidelines making 3 moves. First is what seems to be a new path to proving vertical harm, which seems to be related to Brown Shoe in guideline 6. Which includes a presumption against vertical mergers involving one party with a 50% share. And the second is a possible new entrenchment and extension framework in Guideline 7, which asks whether a firm with a 30% market share is having its position entrenched or extended in some way by the merger. Then third is a concern with mergers that further a trend toward vertical integration. That's Guideline 8. So how would you characterize these tools? Are they new economic tools? Are they development of old economic tools? Or are they specific applications of, you know, one or the other concern that's come up in the recent years with vertical enforcement? I'd love to, Aviv, get your view on that and then see if we can't get others to chime in.
Okay, so let me try. I mean, there's a lot in your question.
Yeah.
There's at least 3 different topics there. So let me try to just get 1, because otherwise I'll be talking here for a long time, or even longer than I have, I should say. So let me just focus on the pure vertical, so not the entrenchment, not
right.
The trend. So there's two guidelines that one, you know, could say to a more traditional vertical. So first is guideline 5, that in terms of layout really follows pretty closely to the 2020 vertical merger guideline. So what's new here? I would say two main things. The first, that it's in these guidelines, right? So that in itself is actually a big change of saying, look, it's the same framework that we used to evaluate horizontal mergers. We're going to look at mergers that potentially could raise vertical concerns, okay? This might seem like sort of trivial, but it's not. And it goes back to actually a point that Rohan made on the previous panel. When we think of the tools that are in the appendix and elsewhere, we say it's the same tools that are going to be evaluating the merger, right? It's a unified way to look at things, okay? That's one. The other change here, and consistent with that, is to say the way we should evaluate mergers that have these vertical effects is the same way that we evaluate horizontal mergers, which is to have a first you establish harm, then you start thinking of whether there's rebuttal arguments. I don't necessarily mean just in court in terms of burden shifting, but the way that the agencies, even during the investigation, think about it. Okay. You first start to ask, is there harm from this merger? What should we be thinking about? Right? And then we say, is there offsetting effects? It's saying there will not lead to a lessening of competition. So in horizontal, and sorry, in you know, non-horizontal deals, vertical deals, I think there's a large part of the antitrust community and the economic profession that almost has a presumption of efficiencies. They say, hey, if a merger is vertical, it has a presumption that it's efficient. I think that's fundamentally a wrong way to think about things. Not to say that there aren't efficiencies. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying we need to start by asking what is the harm that we're worried with. And the harm in its base, it's really actually a horizontal concern, right? So, if Chris, you and I, if we are rivals, okay, that's one if. I'll have several ifs here. But if we are rivals, okay, and let's say substantial rivals, and I get control over something that you need to compete, that's important for you to compete, you could say, that doesn't sound very good, right? I got a chokehold over you, or, you know, you could use other kind of more colorful metaphors to kind of express, but I'm in a position to now impact what you do, and that does not sound good. Now, how do I use that? I could use that by raising your cost, right? I could use that by denying access to you. Or I can just use it to sort of say, hey, you know, Chris, there's this thing I want to do. Play along with me. If you don't play, you know, I'm going to start squeezing where it hurts, right? But there's a few ifs along that way. It's the fact that I have control. I have the ability then to, you know, to squeeze, to deny you the access, and that we're rivals, right? So that's what 5 tries to do. It's the traditional tools, but casting in a different way. Now, if we establish that, then we go to what we call rebuttal. But again, not rebuttal in presenting in court. Then we go and evaluate, are there pro-competitive arguments that will then offset this concern? Say, yeah, maybe it's a concern, but what it does is it makes me more efficient, and therefore I will compete with you more aggressively and would actually increase competition. Okay? That's the idea. So that's 5. Now, you might ask, okay, let's go to 6, and what is the presumption there? So there we did it. 6 introduces a couple of things. So let's break that into half. Let me take the first half, which is that 50% share.
Yeah.
And then I'll deal with the second half when we talk about trends. So what does a 50% share try to do? It's trying to do exactly that, what I've just described. We need to work a little bit on the wording, right? So if I told you instead of 50%, I told you what a merger will do is will give one rival a monopolist position over something that another rival finds important to compete. You would say, okay, that sounds a lot. Well, you just said in 5, that's something we should be concerned with. Okay, that's if you want, you know, I'm looking now at Doug, that's kind of the economic foundation, if you want, for that. Now, there was a few steps in there, right? I used the word monopolist instead of have, you know, control. Where do we get monopolist? Well, in other cases of the law, 50% is often perceived as kind of roughly a threshold for having a monopolist position, okay? The other two key components are there that it's an important input. So it's not I have control over paper clips that you might use, but you know, surely they're not that important. That's a place I think we need to clarify. And the other important is the fact that Chris and I, or you know, whoever the rival is, we're significant rivals. So it's not just sort of some random thing that some other person would want. It's a significant rival that I might then use to try to track. That's the idea behind it. That's the logic behind it. I think we need to refine it because we definitely at least need to explain it better, but we need to refine
Aviv, it. Aviv, quick question within that topic. So efficiencies, when you are talking about rebuttal, how demanding do you think it makes sense to be about whether these efficiencies are likely to eventuate, like 50%, 60%, 70%? I mean, I'm confused about this, and I think a lot of people are.
Okay. So let me take, I think that ties to a general comment on a lot of things. I know, I don't know if we'll get to talk about like potential competition
yeah,
and the interaction with that and entry. One thing to think of just conceptually, and this goes both to the kind of the risk assessment framework. If we think that the framework, and I think there's agreement from what I heard on the panel, that the framework is that we don't have to show harm with certainty, but there's a certain probability. Okay, so I don't know what that number is. Let me just make up a number just for the sake of you. Suppose we say we need to show that there's a 10% likelihood of a lessening of competition. And instead of 10, use whatever number you want. That's that. Okay? Now, remember that in the rebuttal, right, and whether it's efficiencies or not, you don't have to then show, okay, there's 10% chance that the efficiency will be realized. You, in some sense, have to show at least 90% chance that they will be enough to offset the harm, right? It's kind of the mirror. And I think that's kind of the part of the issue here. So obviously we can't put exact probabilities, but that's why when we think through all of this stuff, whether it's efficiencies, whether it's entry, whether all the rebuttal argument, there's a higher threshold that comes from this idea that it's a probabilistic framework.
So I want to pause on this for a second. So, and I want to ask those on the panel. So Aviv, one thing you said was, look, there's some people who believe that vertical mergers are almost, you know, definitionally going to be efficient. I think it's fair to say that that's a view that has really been challenged lately. And I want to get the sense of the rest of the panel of two things. First, whether you think that challenge, that the new thinking on vertical mergers has been successfully integrated into this draft. And second, and maybe Jennifer, specifically for you, whether you get the sense that judges are willing to listen to, you know, large shifts that are underway about thinking about vertical mergers, something this big, right? So of course, like there was a Chicago Revolution, so large shifts in the way we think about antitrust have integrated themselves into judicial thinking in the past. And it's a big question, but Jennifer, I'm curious whether you think it's gonna happen in the future. So there's an economic question there and a lawyer's question. I'm interested in your thoughts.
I'm happy to start. I do think one thing that Aviv said jumped out at me is that, you know, any time that you're putting something in the guidelines that a large part of the antitrust community disagrees with and thinks fundamentally the opposite, I think that that becomes a real problem for the acceptance of the guidelines in court. And, you know, the issue, and I think Rohan alluded to this earlier, but you know, the issue is that you've got to bring the right cases. If you put out the guidelines as they are now, and the first case you go to court with is one where it's a vertical merger and you're basing it on a 50% share, then you're going to get an opinion that says these, or you're likely to get an opinion that says these aren't persuasive, that even the antitrust community disagrees with these. And then you really have set yourself up for failure with the rest of the guidelines. So that's like kind of an initial reaction. Anything that's like, that's in the guidelines that is like, well, a lot of people fundamentally disagree with this who are very smart and well-respected in this field. I think that's an issue for including it in the guidelines and creates real risks. Whether courts are going to eventually agree with the framework, the basic framework of, you know, the ability and incentive to foreclose, I think we have a lot of cases in process right now that are considering that, and we'll see. And it might be the kind of thing where you keep going at it, and eventually you get the right set of facts and the right court, and you convince the court. I don't think you convince the courts by putting it in a guideline, and particularly for something that's so unsettled as that.
You think you convince them by bringing the right case?
Yeah, by bringing the right case with the right facts where they can see the harm that's caused.
Yeah, it brings up a big question, which maybe we'll get to
and
later.
And let me just add, and arguing it in the right way.
Yeah, of course.
So, yep. And again, not to say it was
It wasn't me.
No, but...
no, for
because
sure.
Because the one thing to sort of note is to say, it's one thing, it's like, oh, we've been winning all these vertical cases, you know, if it doesn't work, if it works, why, you know, touch it?
Yeah.
But if it doesn't work, you know, shouldn't we try something different? And that's what we're trying to do here. Again, it's not fundamentally different tools. It's a fundamental different framing, and one that, by the way, Steve Salop has been arguing for a long time, is to say we start from convincing judge, and this goes back to something Rohan said earlier, we first need to convince the court that there's real harm, right? And not to say we're not going to evaluate the potential benefits. We are, right? And the courts aren't, right? It's just that if we don't pass that, you know, if we can't pass that first stage, we're done. So maybe we shouldn't even, you know, be in this business. And that's, I think, you know, I think it's just a matter of rephrasing the arguments that we have to do if we want to start winning critical cases.
Yeah.
Can I, let me just add, for me, there's confusion here because the guidelines can serve different purposes. One purpose is simply to characterize what the agencies are actually doing, which I've always thought is sort of a primary purpose of the guidelines. And if you explain clearly what the agencies are doing, that will obviously have an import to the courts. What concerns me about portions of the guidelines, particularly the vertical portion, is it's forward-looking. I read it as saying, here's what we hope the agencies can do successfully when they get to court, but it's less a description of, I believe, a description of what the agencies are actually doing. And any time there's a number tossed out like 50%, that, at least to me, is not well supported. I worry about that. I do think there are very strong arguments about why vertical deals can be problematic, that the guidelines spell out, and I think with just some rewriting, that can be more powerful. personally, I barely tell my students about double marginalization because I actually think that efficiency claim is often exaggerated, that they're often deals that can be dealt with through contract more readily, and the agencies are right to take a hard look at it. So vertical foreclosure should play a prominent role. The other thing that confuses me a bit in the guidelines is, I know in your example, Aviv, you talked about someone being monopoly. What it means to have monopoly power to me is unclear at various points in the guideline. The word concentration is used a lot. When I read the word concentration, I actually think monopoly power. And as you know, Aviva, you know this, the courts have cited various shares to translate into monopoly power, and we could debate what the right number is, but I think leading into the vertical discussion, we had a little clearer clarification of what concentration really meant would be easier, because I think the vertical deals are problematic almost always result from a firm that has real monopoly power, and that could be clarified.
Andy, just wanted to put the question to you whether you think the vertical elements of the guidelines have translated well the new thinking about the harm of vertical mergers. Is there something there that you like or something there that should be there that isn't there?
You know, as Aviv said, the incentive ability model carries over. That's there.
Yeah.
You know, the one that is sticking out as really new is the idea of a vertical structural presumption.
Yes.
And the courts have said, in vertical cases, they've said there is a burden-shifting framework like Baker Hughes that applies, but Philadelphia National Bank, not so much.
Yeah.
As in, not at all. So I'm sort of intrigued by the idea of having some kind of vertical structural presumption. I'm worried that it be well articulated and supported so that it will be persuasive to courts. And as Aviv was saying, I think whether it succeeds in court will be whether or not the full evidence is there. A test case is going to have to be a good test case to show that the vertical conduct is likely to have the horizontal effect.
So a good test case would be one that isn't right at the threshold, right? That one that's comfortably above the threshold, but one in which there's evidence that can be used to demonstrate to the court that this threshold is meaningful. In other words, that the kind of harmful effects that you see are related to the possession of market share that is somewhat close to the threshold, right?
Yeah.
That's the case.
I think you could imagine a case that fits well into both G5 and G6.
Right.
So the structural presumption is supported by the evidence of incentive and ability, and maybe some bad documents that suggest we have the incentive ability because of our market share and because of barriers to entry or, you know, other factors that would make it a good litigatable case. So that would be, you know, the best test case. And it maybe not be one case. Maybe it's going to be a series of cases to build acceptance in the courts. What are you fighting against? You're fighting against, you know, the footnote in Amex that says, you know, vertical presumed somehow better. And what has that meant? It's meant raising the burden of proof in vertical cases and ignoring a obviously important thing that Aviv said at the start, that it's not about vertical effects. It's about vertical conduct with horizontal effects. We can turn to our friend Justice Scalia in Business Electronics, who said that vertical cases are ultimately about horizontal effects. So you put together the right evidence, and maybe you can package one or more cases that give substance to G6 by maybe linking it to G5.
Our time is going by really quickly, and I wonder if we could just move to an antecedent question, which is market definition tools and frameworks. So, you know, looking at the guidelines, there's continuity and there's some change. So the hypothetical monopolist test is still included, but it's now in a list of four means of defining the market, and it follows alternatives including the Brown Shoe practical indicia, which were mentioned earlier. The Smollett Marcus principle seems to have dropped out, but the draft states that agencies will challenge a merger that appears harmful in any market that's properly defined. So, Aviv, how does 2023 change? How does it keep continuity with the market definition toolkit that we've seen from 2010? And are those changes likely to affect, going forward, the agency's enforcement agenda?
So thank you, Chris, for kind of pushing ahead to that point, because going back to kind of the original question that we kind of set up here, what's different here in the toolkit? In my view, that's actually, and I'll talk about it, what we try to do with market definition is one of the biggest practical changes. I realize there are a lot of conceptual, philosophical differences, and so forth, but at the end of the day, you look how are the guidelines used, how are they cited by courts, it's usually for the, you know, the detailed stuff that's right now in the appendix. That's usually where it's sort of cited, and that's why what we're trying to, you know, to do here, I think, has potentially the most important ramification. So let me again step back. Looking at issues, where did we, you know, agencies find that a lot of times we lose cases is on market definition, right? There's actually, you know, litigators, I don't know if Jennifer agrees, but there's litigators kind of would say, well, where we, you know, where the government ends up losing cases is exactly on the market definition. So we tried to do a couple of things here. First, I already mentioned, we tried with guideline 2 that goes directly at competitive effects and say, look, at cases where the market definition is too hard, we go directly to competitive effects. Okay? The language is there in 2010, but I think we sort of highlighted, emphasized that even more and really made that a very clear pathway to go. Whether we go that way, who knows, but that's one possibility. Specifically though, with market definition, we also made a couple of you know, subtle, but I think very important changes. So one is in the main document, we now really talk about, there's four ways there, but really one is about establishing dominance. So there's really three ways in which we talk about defining market definition. All of which, by the way, again, are in 2010, but they're laid out a little bit differently here. So the first of these is direct evidence. Okay, we could say when there's direct evidence of competition, we could say, all right, so if there's, we have direct evidence, Chris, that you and I are competing, that means we're competing in some market. So even if we can't name that market, we satisfy the any market requirement, saying there is some market out there in which we compete. Do we really need to put a name to it if the evidence of direct competition is substantial enough? Okay, so that's the first. Again, it's there, the elements of there are in 2010, but I think we've kind of run a little bit further with it. The second is to say, second way of defining market is using kind of the Brown Shoe practical indicia type of analysis. Again, it's in 2010, it's in the case law, it's been done. Usually it's been viewed as defining a broad market, and one that the market, that the agencies like to walk away from. Okay? But we actually say, yes, that is a legitimate way to define a market. And I'll say in a second how we see that being used potentially. Okay? The third is the traditional hypothetical monopolist test. Right? Now, one could sort of say we're downgrading the HMT, the hypothetical monopolist test, by now saying it's one of several other methods, right? While in the past, we kind of say, well, Brown, Chewing, practical indicia, they kind of lead to the HMT, and HMT is the ultimate test. So the reason we've done this is, I think, the other big change here, and it's a change that, again, the seeds of it are in 2010, but we're kind of building further, and to say the law requires us to define any market. Doesn't require us to define the best market. Doesn't require us to say, you know, we have to show that there's no harm, that there's, you know, no harm in any, you know, in all the other markets, right? All we have to do is define, you know, one market in which there is harm. So we're going to run with that any market. Now, obviously, we can't just define any, you know, just pull out of thin air a market. It does have to satisfy certain criteria, and those are the criteria outlined by those three principles. But once it does, let me then say it's a kosher market once it satisfies one of those criteria. Once we have a kosher market, we then have to show there's a lessening of competition in that market, and that's when we go to any one of the guidelines of how we show that. Okay? So the idea is if we prevail on that, if we have a kosher market that we show harm, we've met our burden. Okay? Parties can't come and say, hey, wait, there's a better market, right? And in that market, there's no harm. Because guess what? Any merger, there's a lot of markets where there's no harm. Right? So the point is here, can we tell sort of the court, all we have to show is that it's a kosher market. So that can be attacked by saying our market does not satisfy the HMT, does not satisfy the practical indicia, in which case, you know, it's not a kosher market. Okay? That's one. Or they can say, yeah, you have a market, but there's no harm in it. What we're trying to get off the table is an argument that I think logically makes no sense, which is, yeah, there's harm in your market, but there's a better market to look at. We're trying to get that off the table. And because of that, we're willing to say, look, a lot of times we'll fight, again, traditionally, the HMT battles of to make sure we have a market, especially if we're going to rely on structure. But in cases we're going to walk away from structure, we're going to say, hey, we get to define, you know, we can go broad. We're pretty sure it will pass the HMT if we go broad, but that's kind of, you know, an alternative way to go. So that's kind of the logic of what we're trying to do.
So I want to ask the rest of the panel, one way to look at this is as consistent with the spirit of 2010. In other words, it's an outgrowth of what was kind of imminent in 2010, but maybe not explicit about the flexibility of market analysis. Another way to look at this is as it's finally facing the question, an important question of, you know, what are we doing when we're defining markets? Are we defining a market or the market, right? And what I'm hearing in this discussion is that the draft is pretty firmly on the side of we're defining a market, not necessarily the market. Is that going to be the way this turns out, and you know, what will courts make of it?
I missed the last part, but I know there's another flood warning.
Yeah. Sorry. What are courts going to make of it if this is a shift to defining a market, right? Any market.
So I have this distinct recollection, maybe someone will confirm or refute this, but the 2010 guideline initial draft tried to say market definition is not necessary to every case. Didn't it say that? And then they backed away because there was so much pushback to that. Market definition is not a problem just for mergers. This is a problem for antitrust law. Market definition is the hill on which plaintiffs, including the government, go to die, and defendants are going to protect that hill because it's proven to be a very powerful tool for pushing back. It's satellite litigation like standing in private cases where you wind up litigating this esoteric question of what is the relevant market, has the government met the burden of the relevant market, and I was a little bit sorry that in 2010 we backed away from the idea, and I think that as Chris's question puts it is correct, these guidelines are trying to sort of take that one step further and essentially say market definition in the way that we are doing it, in this sort of formal way that courts are doing it, is not going to be necessary to every case when we have other indications of loss of competition. To me, that's no different from accepting the quick look concept, that sometimes we have more direct effects evidence and we don't need to, and the court has said it in NCAA and Indiana Federation, that market share analysis is a surrogate, and when we have the direct evidence, we don't need to do it. I would like to see that, at least for horizontal mergers, more firmly established. Again, it's about the right case. That and I think it may be harder to do prospectively.
Yeah.
It might be easier to do up for obvious reasons with a consummated merger.
So, Jennifer, are judges expecting to see the market? So, or would they be open to the idea that, you know, the government chose a market that's defensible and the defendants have different views, but, you know, if the market is defensible, that definition will control?
Yeah, I mean, the government has the burden of proof to prove a market,
yeah,
and to prove the relevant antitrust market for that case. So I think, you know, the idea that you can kind of forego that and do something else is really contrary to the case law and is going to be a very difficult position to take. One of my concerns, just putting back on my, like, agency litigator hat, is that the clarity of it's the HMT that we use was really helpful in winning a lot of cases. And, you know, when you've kind of elevated Brown Shoe to the same you know, kind of analytical weight, there are, you know, a number of cases I can think of that the agency won that it would have lost if and we haven't gotten the chance to talk about it, but when you're adding also into this idea of perceived potential competition and people just outside the market that are constraining people in the market, when you put those concepts together and say, oh yeah, and it's Brown Shoe, we're going to look at your documents and see who you think of as your competitors, I think that puts the agency in a difficult spot. I think the clarity of saying we've got a market that meets the HMT is helpful, not harmful to the agency. And I think this idea that courts were just doing this, technical market definition and that was bad for the FTC, I think, or for the agencies, I think is a little bit wrong. I think courts have been hearing, you know, it's the same trial in which everybody's presenting the competitive effects evidence and is presenting the market definition evidence. And at the end of the day, all of that is being considered together when the court says, actually, I think this is a broader market. I think the agency didn't meet its burden of proof. It's not like they're doing that in isolation before hearing the competitive effects evidence. So I think I would be concerned, if I was still an agency attorney doing this, that this that setting it up this way gives defendants really a lot more to work with to fight back on
a market. So, Jennifer, can I ask you about that? Like the position of the lawyers at the FTC actually litigating cases versus the guidelines, you know, the rules set down there. So if you're in that position and you see a case where, look, we got a clean story on the hypothetical monopolist test, and, you know, a Brown Shoe story is never clean, right? A Brown Shoe story may be very helpful in the right case, but it's definitely never clean. Is the culture of the litigators at the FTC just that we're going to just cut to the chase, right? We're not bound to the hypothetical monopolist test. We're not limited to it, but it's going to help us here, and we're just going to do what we need to do to get through market definition successfully.
So in every case that I can think of sitting here right now, we've briefed both.
Yeah.
You brief Brown Shoe and you brief HMT. But at the end of the day, when the court's making a decision, you say you get there and you say everything's pointing in the same direction. The harm to competition evidence, the customer complaints, the evidence of head-to-head competition, and the HMT are all pointing in the same direction. And that's ideally the position that you're in when you're in court. And I think this, if you're elevating this, but you don't need Brown Shoe and that's now more important, I would be concerned about that.
Got it. Dan?
Yeah, I was just going to say I have some experience just having served as an expert in a number of merger cases. And a couple points just struck me. One is, I'm always very interested in what I believe the competitive effects of a deal will be. And if I think I know what the competitive effects are based on whatever analysis I've done, there will be a market definition which will allow me to tell the story about competitive effects. And that market definition hopefully will be supported by other documents and evidence from witnesses. But relying on that alone without doing something like an HMT exercise, I think it's dangerous just because there are always going to be documents and people, particularly salespeople, who will give very different perspectives. My experience is the salespeople define markets really narrowly because they only look at the two closest competitors. pricing people look at markets very broadly, and probably too broadly. And I can just think of two quick examples of where this mattered without going too much detail. I was involved in a serial merger many years ago where I was the witness for the parties against the state of New York in that particular case. And the entire case was litigated about market definition. Was the market all ready-to-eat cereals or just adult cereals? The key testimony being that that adults once ate kids' cereals and still secretly like it. But the other expert and I fought about the econometrics of how to apply the hypothetical monopolist test. And there was also a court-appointed expert. And ultimately, I think the judge in the case is very thoughtful. Combined all that evidence, but without the econometrics, I don't think the court would have been very comfortable about that. Another example that came to mind is I was involved for the parties working on the United Continental merger, and there was a trial brought in California to try to block the merger. And a key issue in the case was the market narrowly defined to be the sort of top three or four airlines, or did it include some of the other airlines? And that could have been a big deal in the case. The interesting part of that litigation, again, I did all the econometrics. I think the econometrics clearly supported a somewhat broader market than the plaintiff claimed in the case. But I have to confess that the key to winning the case was when the named plaintiffs in the class case came forward and admitted that they flew on the airlines that were not allegedly in the market that the plaintiffs claimed. Needless to say, this caught the judge's attention. I'd like to think it was my econometrics that won the case, but I'm not so sure.
Yeah, that's the fact that tells. I want to get Andy in here.
So can I just ask, yeah. I actually really like to hear the answer to you more than like present our view. So yeah. One thing, Dan, I'm not quite sure when I heard you, say you don't like what we did, but then I think all the examples you gave are examples that I would use to support what we did. So I'm just a little bit confused because I thought what I heard you say is that using Brown Shoe will end up with markets that are too narrow. And I think our underlying kind of our thinking is that actually Brown Shoe will typically lead to broader markets, which if we go to competitive effects under guideline two, it's like, okay, let's go there and talk about competitive effects. And you know,
I would go both ways. I would say if you just use Brown Shoe, it could go either way. I can think of Brown Shoe leading me to narrow markets. It may have suggested that, but I agree it can also lead to be very broad markets. So that's why I'd like to try to put more weight on the HMT. Whether or not it gives you a numerical answer, I think it provides you a clearer framework. So I'm a little concerned that the discussion is too broad, actually, in the guidelines and just could be tightened up.
I wanted to get Andy in on market definition, and then also I want to talk briefly about potential competition and then get to questions. So, Andy?
Just listening to our discussion sort of begs the question that I think one question the guidelines are trying to get at, which is there a simpler way to do this?
Yeah.
And we keep coming around. You know, I did it myself. Well, combine G5 and G6, and listening to Jennifer talk about, I mean, the government has been forced to litigate fully every case. And the question is there some relief for that? Is there some way, is there a quick look version of merger analysis? And I think in some sense the guidelines are trying to find that as a way of defining a space where you don't have to belt and suspenders every case, and it shouldn't be that hard. There should be some cases that are easier to prove. I don't know that we've answered that question today, but I think that's lurking as we start to describe what it still takes to win. And maybe these are big cases, there's a lot at stake, and it warrants the use of resources, but that's still, to me, a lurking issue.
Okay, so let's talk about potential competition before getting into questions. So the draft, as far as I can tell, seems to move the focus merger risk to the risk of entry or the perceived risk of entry and perceived potential competition cases, again, away from the assessment of competitive effects following entry.
So is that a big change in terms of the theory behind potential competition cases? And is that guidance going to help courts to see these cases clearly?
So I'm not sure I have an answer to all of those. Yeah. Let me touch on the things
potential
that I can.
Answers.
Yeah, potential answers. I have some nascent perceived potential answers. Yeah, exactly.
So
you got it.
So definitely guideline for the potential competition is clearly something new. I think there was no, I think that's one, I have to be careful because there might have been some footnote somewhere in 2010 that hinted at it, but I think that is a new idea. I think, you know, the layout and the ideas sort of behind that are things that actually come from a lot of what, you know, was argued and basically accepted on the legal side, on the theory side, by the court in Meta Within, right, which talked exactly about this doctrine. This is obviously a case that the FTC lost, but we lost on the facts, not on the court actually accepted the theory for the most part. So that's kind of the... what's the idea there? I wouldn't say that it's not based on competitive effects. It is based on competitive effects, but sort of saying this is a potential competition, one that hasn't, you know, the competition hasn't actually been there, so you can't actually rely on market shares. You know, it's going to be very hard to do econometric analysis because this is, you know, I mean, you could simulate a data of here is what it might be and then do econometric analysis, but good luck convincing a court that that's actually meaningful. But that's, I think, kind of the idea here, is to lay a framework of saying, look, there's competition, we think it's about to happen, and it'll be lost by the merger, whether it's actual competition, right, of, you know, you're acquiring me, and but for the acquisition, we'd end up butting heads and competing.
I mean, the we here is other competitors, right? So they seem to think.
Well, that's the perceived part. So there's a direct potential competition, or there could be an element that you might not actually have plans to enter, but just the mere fact that, you know, others think that you might enter might actually change the other folks in the market might think that you might enter would change what they do. That's kind of the idea behind the paradigm. I think the real issue would be here is, well, how do you prove that? How do you get, and I think that was the what the, you know, the FTC faced. I mean, it was before my time. The FTC faced in Meta Within was, how do you get, what's the fact pattern that you'd be able to convince a court saying, okay, this is not a theory, not just a theory, but one sort of a practical.
Yeah, so Jennifer, you had seen some link between the perceived potential competition theory and market definition. And it was interesting when you articulated it. So could you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, to me personally, this seems like one of the most potentially damaging things in the guidelines from my point of view. And to be clear, I think there's a lot that's great in the new guidelines, and I really respect the really hard work that folks did on them, and there's a lot that's really good. But to me, this is one of the most dangerous things because you can't, the guidelines right now say that a perceived potential competitor restrains the companies in the market and incentivizes them to offer lower prices and higher quality goods. I don't think you can say that in one part of the guidelines and then say in another part of the guidelines they're not part of the market. I don't think you get to do a heads I win, tails you lose on that. And I think when I think back to cases that we litigated either fully or we brought complaints and people abandoned, there are a ton of cases where the merging party said, oh, well, you know, Google might enter or so-and-so might enter and that constrains us. And the agency rejected that argument, said they're not entering and they're not part of the market. And I think once you've said that actually the perceived potential competition is a real constraint on people in the market, that you've kind of destroyed the hospital merger program, right? Because there's always a big university hospital just outside the market. There's always somebody that documents, internal documents
show. It's
going to
build a facility within the geographic area.
Right, exactly. So I think that's my concern with it, is that there's just an internal inconsistency from my perspective of to say they are a real constraint if they're a perceived potential competitor, and then elsewhere to say that they're, to suggest they're not.
So let me just kind of address, because I think laid the seeds for this in the comments I made before about rebuttal. So first, thank you. It's, you know, it's very important, a part of going out here to actually highlight things that, you know, maybe things we haven't thought about, because, you know, the defense bar is actually very good at finding ways to, hey, you said this here and that there and using it against the agencies. So, look, I agree that there's a risk there, okay? I don't think there's an inconsistency, but again, the question is how it would be viewed in court. And the inconsistency goes back to what I was saying before, is this asymmetry that you have between a potential risk of competition, right? So if you say, a risk of a lessening of competition, right? So if you basically say, let's say it's a 10%, I'm going to go back to that same example, of a lessening of competition, that says that you don't just need a 10% of potential entry, you need basically over 90% to offset that,
yeah.
Right? And that's kind of the asymmetry here. Now, whether that will be understood and accepted, I don't know. And even if it is, you could say, okay, it doesn't completely take that argument off. It's just a question of now when you think of this potential entrant or the impact that it has, is it high enough, right? There's a higher threshold for the efficiency than there is for the lessening of competition. Again, and it goes directly from the fact that it's not about certainties, it's about probabilities. And key in it, by the way, is the fact that when I say probabilities, I'm assuming that probability, I don't know if it's 10%, but it's less than 50%, right? Because otherwise, the whole math sort of turns around.
Okay.
So that's, I think, the logic of it. You know, there's a risk, I admit. That's.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right that the two things are linked. They're not symmetrical. And the question is whether judges are going to see that. Because I do think this simple linkage argument is going to have some appeal. So why don't we take some questions? Tim?
Sure. Let's try the mic again.
I have a question. It's almost a comment about agency enforcement strategy. The first, I feel like, this is just kind of editorial comments. I feel that potential competition does introduce all these contradictions and challenges. And haven't the agencies been a lot more successful with challenging nascent, with the crushing of nascent competitors instead? Like in the Microsoft case, like the Visa Plaid, you know, the courts seem to see it, little guy, and become more dangerous later, kill them. But that feels like a much more successful kind of thing, these sort of esoteric, weird theories about how someone was constraining them. And, you know, they're even hard to teach. The names are bad. The labeling is weird. So I just kind of encourage agencies. I don't know if I'm talking to you right now, but it hasn't been the most profitable line. And then a question, a lot of the panel, you know, seem to have excitement in the vertical area, bring sort of a threshold, close to a threshold case or something like that. And I guess the academic in me appreciates that, but wouldn't it be better to win a vertical case and choose one with a big, fat monopoly that seemed to be abused vertically? Maybe a very popular case, maybe a ticket seller, for example.
Hypothetically.
Doesn't that seem like a better litigation strategy than trying to get, like, a 51% threshold and thin the needle and leave a lot of academics?
So, a few things.
Yeah.
So in terms of potential competition, the one potential competition case that was litigated, and I was the DOJ's expert on it, was Saber Farelogix. And, you know, it was potential competition, although it was actually evidence of actual competition, yet
right.
The court somehow got caught up in a footnote in an Amex that twisted the whole thing around. Visa Plaid is an interesting one. It came right after that. I think the DOJ learned lessons from Saber Farelogix. It wasn't ever litigated. It was abandoned. It was actually an interesting case because it's, I mean, there might be others. It was actually a case that had a Section 2 claim in it, in addition to a Section 7. So, look, I agree with you that out of the potential competition, I think the more interesting one is the actual potential competition as opposed to the perceived potential competition.
Right, and I'm saying, junk it all, I'll talk about
these. I think that's what the potential competition does. I mean, you know, we can talk about wording, but I think that's what it does. In terms of, look, just going back to the vertical, look, I agree with you. And by the way, one of the things I worry about, and my guess is maybe that's what will end up changing, the thing I worry about, the 50%, is not anything that was discussed here. It's actually the opposite. It's not, we're going to try to bring a case of vertical, and you could sort of see the defendant sort of saying, okay, you didn't define, because, you know, remember, under Guideline 5, we don't have to define the related product market. Just say what the related product is, right? But when you want a market share, now you need a market. So I could imagine defendants coming and saying, okay, now let's define a market, and guess what? You're not even close to 50%. In that market, you're only 10%, right? You're so below this, you know, yes, it's not a safe harbor, but you're so below, you know, what you said that was already radical. You know, good luck litigating that case. So that's kind of actually my concern more with that structural threshold on the vertical. But I agree with you. That's what we're trying to do is let's try to change the things and find a way to win, finally, a vertical case. That's
Daniel?
Can I ask about what's new on the vertical front? Because so much of this discussion, whether it's on verticals or on potential competition, is about frameworks that have been in the law for decades, right? Potential competition is not just in 2010, it's in the first sentence of 2010. And the FTC and DOJ have been bringing potential competition cases for a long time. This is long before, you know, within Steris, Polyport, Yamaha, like there's decades of this. But one area where 2023 seems to try to break new ground is guideline 6 on the vertical. And let's set aside the structural presumption. I think it'd be really cool if we could implement guideline 5, traditional vertical frameworks, through some structural presumption. I don't think it works in a single market, because then you have a situation where I've got 50% market share, I look downstream, I see an oligopoly, I want to break it up, so I buy a minnow in order to disrupt competition, and now I've run into your presumption of anti-competitive effects. But the idea of that presumption to approximate 5 is really interesting. But there's a lot in 6 other than that structural presumption. So the question for anyone who wants it is, what is the principle that Guideline 6 expresses that is not channeling 5?
So let me take that, because unless anyone else wants to, you know, give the perception of what they what we actually wrote. So I mean, there's a question as to, you know, what it is that we're trying to sort of do. Let me sort of, you know, jump over that and really go into. So 6 really has two parts to it, as I kind of alluded to earlier. It's the first part, it's the kind of, I call static, you know, presumption. The second part talks about trends, or trends toward vertical integration, among other things, but that's the key part of it. So that's the part we never really got to,
yeah.
Which is I would put together that together with, I'll use numbers, but I'll tell you what they are in a second, Guideline 8 and Guideline 9. So Guideline 8 is the general trend towards concentration, not just vertical, horizontal. And Guideline 9 is one saying if there's a series of acquisitions that the agencies will actually evaluate that, or potentially evaluate that is one. Right, and the series here is a series by one acquirer. That's kind of different between 9 and 8. I would put all of those under one, you know, one title, and maybe actually we'll end up in the final, we'll see, of dynamic competition. Okay? And the idea there, kind of again, let's step back from, you know, the specifics. The idea there is actually, I think, one that's totally non-controversial. Right? You can allude to old case law, whatever, but it's actually one that I think is completely in the mainstream, which is when we evaluate competition, it's not just about taking a snapshot. It's actually looking in the context of where the industry is going or where it might be going, right? And again, we can refer to old case laws kind of if you want to reference that, but I think that idea is not really a controversial one, right? And it can go, by the way, in different directions, right? I mean, there was a lot of discussions of airlines. If you go look at the US Air American complaint that I was at the DOJ at the time and took a big part of it. It starts by actually showing a graph of how the industry has been consolidating, going back, you know, for a decade even before that. Right? By the way, I find it ironic that here we are again in October talking about an airline merger and a government shutdown, exactly as we did in 2013. But but anyway, but that's the idea that all of these are trying to do. Details still need to be worked out, but that's, I think, what we're trying to get at is to sort of say, look, you need to look at dynamics, where the industry is going, whether it's heading towards a general direction of lessening competition, we should look within that context, or maybe even the opposite, looking at entry. Suppose that actually you see an industry that right now, it's still, you know, fairly concentrated and using thresholds, we might be worrying about lessening competition, but there actually seems to be a lot of new entry, a lot of dynamics going the other way. That would be an argument against just focusing on a structural presumption, looking at that dynamics. That's what we're trying to do. But details, I think, need to be worked out.
We got two people in the queue, Ed and Richard. Ed?
What?
You're second.
Yeah.
Ed and then Richard.
So I want to ask about something I am pleased not to find in the guidelines. So I did a control F search for MHHI, and it turns out nothing. And given the discussion in the last 3 years, including a program here at the FTC on the common ownership debate, I was quite pleased to see that Guideline 12 really restates what I thought was the policy and has been the policy. But in light of that debate, I take it there must have been a decision not to embrace the common ownership approach, either in adjusting thresholds for looks under HHI or in any other process. Is that right?
It's not right.
Richard.
I was puzzled by something that Alpine said, and I hope you can clarify. You mentioned that if you could find some difficulty in a given market, that somehow or other is showing that it's extended, it doesn't have any difficulty. I'm puzzled by the fact that you have a merger with multiple, which operates simultaneously in multiple markets. What are you supposed to do if the concentration ratios go up in one market, unacceptably, let's say, and in another market they start to go down? How is it that you kind of distinguish the two halves? When you're doing this, is that to be taken into a case of the legality point, or is it to be taken in the case when you're framing the particular remedy? I try to write on this as a student, and I can never quite figure it out 60 odd years ago, so I desperately need some clarity.
So I think you'd get, here I'm speaking as an economist, tell you my understanding of how the legal framework is, right? And the idea is that if there's a harm in one market, we generally don't do offsetting of saying, okay, there's benefits in another, we'll do net things out. I mean, economists, of course, will say, hey, you should do that, you should look at the deal as a whole, and that's what you should do, and we can talk about markets or the different geographic markets.
I don't understand, because I'm not an economist, at least by training. But it seems to me if you have the offset and the whole deal is net positive, you either want to approve it on the one hand or figure out a way to excise the net negative part of this thing and keep the positive part going forward. So one of the things that I think we discussed at all in this today was the question on the remedial state. Is the only thing that you do is to block a merger to fail some particular test, or do you try to figure out how to make a more complicated remedial structure so as to sever the good from the bad part?
So a little bit, I think, in what your comment explicitly is, you'd like economists to rule the world, which I generally favor, because you'd like to follow economic principles. So I'm not going to argue against that. But my understanding, and again, I'll let the lawyers in the room speak, is that if there's a harm in any market, that's enough. You don't do the offset. Let me just complete. That's it. Now, that being said, I can tell you from now experience of being in both agencies, there is discretion, right? And think, look, I mean, let me just go again. This is something that was at the time at when I was DOJ, AT&T DirecTV. Actually, that's one we can talk a lot about what was done in investigation because it was actually filing at the FCC by the parties. They had a merger simulation model, a fairly complicated one, that their own merger simulation model, the party's own merger simulation model, showed that in some geographies, some DMAs, there would actually be harm. Others, there would be benefit. And then it would be beneficial. Okay, so the DOJ let that one go through. The FCC, you can actually read kind of their decision, which really talks about that and did a balancing act. Just by inferring by the fact that the DOJ did not challenge it, even though it had right there the evidence by the party saying, hey, there might be harm in this particular market, that they did some offsetting effect at their discretion, right? So that's, I don't think, would be a crazy inference based on
that. Yeah, I'm going to answer the legal question.
The Engelberg Center Live podcast is a production of the Engelberg Center on Innovation, Law, and Policy at NYU Law and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 international license. Our theme music is by Jessica Batke and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 international license.